This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is Xcode 6.
Oh, wow, you're going to cover all of it.
Yes. Yes, okay. Every little thing about Xcode 6. Well, you could call it sort of what's new in Xcode 6. Or, okay, More accurately, yes, What's new in Xcode 6 that Andrew got to before we started recording.
I thought you were going to, you know, cherry pick the various new things and expand each one out to its own episode, and we'd be set for the year. But,
yeah, right.
But I guess we are coming up on that 100 episode deadline, so maybe the YouTube right. Is crunch mode.
Yes, since you apparently think we're going to be shutting down by that point.
I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. We could just talk about it, but, you know, what fun would that be?
This is our, like, cliffhanger. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yes.
Keep our two listeners on the edge of their seats.
You don't know what's going to happen. I have a pretty good idea what's going to happen. But, you know, I'll leave you your mystery.
Okay, I need a cliffhanger then.
Yes. Well, really? You do need a cliffhanger? Okay.
And, you know, I have very little to live for.
Fair enough. So I could call this my first Xcode 6 rant to match my Xcode 4 rant. But in fact, this isn't really much of a rant. I don't have a lot of things to... Well, I do have things to complain about. They are less the features that I'm seeing in here than kind of just me grumbling about how people seem to be perceiving the advancements in Xcode. We'll get to that in a little bit. But no, I don't believe we have any follow-up, right? We were actually just talking about that before the episode started, and then we didn't...
I didn't actually look at the Gmail UI, so I'll just assume we have no feedback.
We'll just assume we don't have no feedback, right. Blissful ignorance is bliss. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is how, well, this is pre-release software, and we've been here before. In fact, I was looking back at old episodes, and pretty much about a year ago, I did an episode called No Carbon This Time Around, which I believe I've joked on Twitter, I keep calling by mistake No Carbon for Old Men, which is my... mistaken reference to No Country for Old Men, right? Mm-hmm. That episode, I talked about the NDA, Apple's NDA, and the philosophy behind it for quite a while during that episode. I'm not going to talk about it all that much time now. And I talked about how it prevented us from talking about as much as we wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And my take on it was, well, Apple appeared to be doing this in order to preserve their secrecy, their surprise, their wow factor for media. Mm-hmm. Magazines, TV shows, I guess, other forms of media, which are the way that consumers find out about Apple's stuff. And it seemed like Apple's overriding priority to do that was spilling over into DevLand, the developer sphere, unnecessarily, because you weren't, in fact, hiding this from any of your competitors or anything like that. And it turns out when they did update the NDA for this year, they pretty much said about that. They said, well, yes, you can talk about this amongst yourselves publicly, but don't do any reviews. The things I that come out that stand out for me from the new NDA that showed up for WWDC was screenshots and public review. They don't want you to do either of those things. So I feel pretty vindicated about that. Now, it's still pretty murky exactly what's allowed because they don't really define their terms in as exact a way as they could. Nobody seems to be making it clear, well, that was just for WWDC. Does that mean everything since WWDC is also like that? Don't know exactly. But it does seem that the way Apple was acting before, they have done more of it. That is good. Now, people who kind of say, well, that means Apple's given us everything we wanted. We've discussed this kind of thing before. Well, no. And I also think that saying, wow, Apple, this is great, it's not my attitude anyway, because it really seems like they're just kind of coming up to closer to what we actually want. It's still not ideal. It's still not what we really want, which is, hey, stop being stupid about this, right? Stop trying to make developers pay the price for your media strategy. But it does mean that they're getting better, and I do give them kudos for that, getting better. And so that's why I'm talking about this now, because otherwise everything in WWDC would be under this NDA, which, you know, blanket, don't talk about it at all. So it is good. Now, I'm going to be talking about this now. I've already written a blog post. I'll be getting to that in a second, where I got some feedback, some corrections from people. All of that cross-fertilization, all of that, how else would you describe it? all of that ferment, public ferment, would not be happening if Apple had not allowed this to happen. So good. It's better. Mm-hmm. So let's see. The first thing I'm going to talk about is what I talked about in my new blog post that I wrote yesterday, which was called Framing Your Work, because I can't help myself. It's about the new iOS frameworks that Apple has introduced as part of Xcode 6, as part of iOS 8, in that you can now have dynamic frameworks in your iOS apps, which is interesting because one of the stated reasons for doing it is so that you can share code without having to put it in several different targets manually for your apps and your app extensions. Right? Does this sound like what you've heard, Wolf?
Yeah. And it's considered a pretty good sign.
Well, it's interesting because you really don't need that. You don't need dynamic frameworks for that specifically.
That's actually true. Now that you talk about it, I read that one posting, who I can't remember who wrote it now, but about how this is actually implemented. I guess initially I thought the application extensions would work by basically just loading like modules of your application, but actually it is actually sublaunching your own entire application.
Yes, extensions are their own binary, mm-hmm. completely separate binary. And I believe that's almost certainly for the sake of, well, it's for performance and it's for security. They want it to be completely separate. And so that also holds true for the frameworks. The framework, you link against the framework in your app extension binary and your app binary. Is that what you meant or something?
No. Actually, it was Michael Tsai linked to this article about how it's implemented. And if I can quickly bring it up, I don't want to tell you what. I'll just try to dig it up while you're talking.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yeah, great. Go ahead. So the point was, why do they do it that way? Because the reason you have dynamic frameworks is because you want to have a framework that can be linked against anything, things you can't imagine at runtime. So like the Foundation framework, it's a dynamic mm-hmm. framework. It can be linked against many things that were not specified when it first shipped.
Right.
And so you don't need that here because you can only link it against it in your iOS application, things that you already know you're going to ship. Keep that in mind. We're going to get back to that. But my post was more about, hey, here's what you need to know as an iOS developer or as a lapsed OS X developer. That's me. Things that I was kind of forgetting from doing my dynamic frameworks from the OS X days. And so some of these things were just those things that you were missing. Some of these things are things which are a little different now. There are some interesting build warnings that you get when you forget to put things in the framework or forget to take things out of your app. Warnings which are not quite what you might expect for, duplicate symbols, things like that. Yeah, you're going to want to look into that. There's a module name in the Zib editor that I had not realized was just for Swift. The module name is not your framework name. It's actually, they should really call that your namespace name in the Zib editor. They do make that clear in some of the sessions that I had only listened to after I wrote that article, but it's still something you might want to know in terms of iOS frameworks. And the one thing that I learned that doesn't appear to be in any of the sessions that I've listened to so far is that if you're going to be using your framework for an app extension, you need to check the checkbox in the deployment info section of your target called Allow App Extension API Only. And if you don't do this, you get a build warning, which says linking against dylib, not safe for use in application extensions. And that really puzzled me for a little while. I was like, but you're not telling me something specific. Like, I know there are APIs that are part of UIKit that you're not supposed to use in extensions. And these are labeled with the NS extension unavailable iOS macro that is documented in some of these WWDC sessions, such as, and I'll put links to these in the show notes, creating extensions for iOS and OS X part 1 and part 2 and building modern frameworks. They're all very helpful. They tell you the concepts behind this, but they don't tell you about that checkbox. So that makes me think maybe the checkbox came a little later when they were done with their session, but not, not done with the deliverables, whatever. But you need that. And once you turn that on, then if you try to use one of these APIs in your framework, you will get a build error during the build of your framework. So it makes sense because otherwise your framework is just this general purpose framework. It doesn't know what uses it's going to be put to. So they wouldn't want to make all these things errors in general, because you might have a framework that's just shared between a couple of apps, and then you should be able to use all these APIs. They probably also don't want to put that check in the linker phase of linking the framework against the app extension. They really want to do it during compile time or during the link time of that application. So what they do is they kind of break encapsulation. They say, well, instead of this being a general purpose framework, now it's a framework that you know is for extensions. Mm. And they do it that way. But it's still, so it's again, it's breaking encapsulation, but it is very nice because it does show you exactly where you need to change your framework to make it work properly. If you don't do that, all of these uses of these APIs will not cause build errors and will actually work at runtime. You can call, what's the one? There's one about getting the application, shared application that is labeled as being unavailable when you're doing extensions. And if you don't set your framework up that way and you link it against an app extension and then you run it in the simulator or on the device, it will run fine. But I'm assuming it would then, your app would be rejected by Apple during the submission to the App Store. So this is good to handle that beforehand. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to me how this is what happens when you have a system, a pre-existing system, that you need to take things out of. And it actually makes sense in two ways with what we're talking about. Because, of course, there was always the capability for linking dilibs against your iOS app as part of the OS.
Right.
Because the OS was built from OS X. It had this functionality. You were all set. And so they had to take that out. And they took that out by kind of taking it out of the Xcode UI and that sort of a thing. And now they're doing it again. Well, there's no reason why you couldn't. There's no way to take an API and say you can't do this in the normal way of doing linker functionality. They could make it not work if, say, the API wasn't available for a different version of the frameworks of the OS, but they couldn't say, well, it's not allowed. And now they can do that because they've added something new to take stuff out. Though it's interesting how Apple deals with that. Mm-hmm. I think that pretty much covers that one. So that's interesting. It does seem to work as advertised. What's interesting about that Building Modern Frameworks session was that because it's so simple, they actually kind of took that framework, and I tweeted about this a little bit, and kind of took it in some different directions and talked about API design, because there really were no new things you needed to do in Xcode to make this work. You just do this one thing, and it works. One weird tip. What? Right? And so they kind of had to fill up the rest of a session. But it does work if you follow those things. So I'm going to put a link to my blog post in there, and you can take a look. The second thing I wanted to talk about was live views, mm-hmm. which are very interesting.
Fair.
Now, these are described in the session 4.11, What's New in Interface Builder. I'm going to be listing a lot of WWDC sessions during this episode. And there's also a developer webpage called Creating a Custom View that Renders an Interface Builder. And so I'll put a link to that as well. Hopefully the link to the developer webpage will last longer than a couple of months, right? And what's interesting is both of these appear to be completely available without you being logged in. There's no login firewall for this sort of thing. It's labeled as being pre-release, but it's not firewalled. So that's good. Yeah. So live views are interesting. I like them. I'm interested in them. Now, in the same way that I talked about how... Actually, did I talk about this earlier? In the same way that allowing iOS frameworks, whereas some people might sort of describe this as, wow, Apple's letting us do this new great thing. Well, no. This is an old thing that they're now letting us do again mm-hmm. with iOS that arguably they should have let us do from day one. Live views are... similarly, giving us back something that Apple had taken away previously. Because previously you had Interface Builder plugins that let you, that they were live views, they ran the code that your custom classes had and showed you the result inside of IB. So mm-hmm. you could see how your app was going to look with your custom classes right then. You didn't have to run the app. It was very useful. It was very handy. Apple took that away with Xcode 4, and there was... interesting thing. Did you ever have to do the thing where you took your custom plugins and you migrated them to Xcode 4, Wolf?
You mean my Interface Builder plugins?
Yeah. Well, like if you open those Interface Builder zibs or nibs, mm-hmm. were they nibs back then? Zibs.
think that
had support for the plugins, they would show you this alert which said, no, you can't do that now. You've got to convert them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what they did was they took the data that was in this custom format and they turned them into the, I have written this down, user-defined runtime attributes. I always forget exactly what those things are called. So they turned something that was specific into this more general mechanism where you could no longer see the preview in Interface Builder, but in theory, it would still kind of run the same way when you actually ran it in your app, because the custom class would still get the same data through this property.
I remember the user-defined runtime attributes are actually really handy, and I didn't know that those actually came up par and parcel with the IB plugin purge, so that's interesting.
I think so. I mean, whether they existed before or not, I'm not sure they did. In any case, yes, they were how you got around the fact that you could no longer use your custom data in Interface Builder Zibs. And so they're giving that back to us now. And it's in some very, very interesting ways. So what you do to say this is going to be a live view is you put a new line above. It doesn't have to be the class decoration. It can apparently can be anywhere. The class definition, the class, a category on the class apparently works too. I haven't tried it. IB underscore designable, all uppercase. For Objective-C, in Swift, it's at IB designable, kind of title IB camel case, whatever it's called. Not all uppercase. It's more of a, anyway, you'll see.
It's camel case, I think.
If you do it. And if you do that, then Interface Builder knows to try to show it as a live view. What's interesting is when I first tried this with my own views, it didn't work. And I tried everything. I tried making something more like what Apple's demos did. But the one thing that I didn't do that I needed to do to make it work is put those classes in a particular place. And Wolf, do you know how this works now?
Yeah, but I cheat because I read your tweets.
All right, fair enough. You need to put them in a framework.
Yeah.
Ta-da! So actually, I think I did say earlier I was going to talk about frameworks some more. It's interesting because if they had said, well, we're going to give you framework, we're going to give you everything that's in a framework, we're going to make it static, that would not have given you this ability to have two different binaries, one that you could run separately and you know, the other one that was your full-on app. And I think having the separate binary is required for live views because they don't want to run your whole app each time and they don't want to run individual classes. They still want to run some sort of defined binary. So when they were deciding, how are we going to do all of the things that we need to do, all of the capabilities, all of the improvements we want Xcode to have, we want the runtime to have, I bet part of the idea of why are we going to give you dylibs was this. I don't think it was the whole reason, but I think it was, you know, it kind of weighed in on, well, now we're going to give them dylibs because, well, we can't figure out how to do this. Now, in some ways, plugins were a more definitive, a more circumscribed way of making that work. Because with a plugin, at least you're only running the plugin. And now, if I've got an app, and it doesn't even have an app extension, but I want live views, well, now I've got to make myself a framework. And that's kind of annoying, right? That I've got to make a framework and put things to the side, increase the complexity of my application solely in order to get live views. Well, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and I read your Framing Your Work piece, and I think you're up to 10 steps or something, and there's a lot of stuff you have to do to break out that framework.
Well, no. I mean, some of those were just, well, don't be stupid. You know, don't forget stuff. No, and there's really only a couple of, there aren't 10 steps. But there is, It is a little bit more. Actually, one of the things that was funny to me was just saying, make a framework, make an app extension, link the two together, and you get that build warning that I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty funny. That's just two steps. It actually is extremely easy to make that framework, but then it's not enough. You need to do a little bit more. So in fact, making frameworks is pretty easy. Let's see where I was. Okay, so that gives you a live view. And that works. Now, one thing that was interesting for me was the first thing I tried, because I'm a bastard, is I said, okay, I'm going to make a live view that animates. That just runs an animation. I called it fan view. And I just made something that twirled slowly over and over and over again. And I was like, you know, take that, Interface Builder. And yes, Interface Builder does not animate your view for you in live view. It does not run all your code. It runs some of your code, but it does. It draws the line. Damn it! I'm not going to animate this thing for you. Which, okay, you know, I can deal with that. But if you do want to have some more control over your view, you can set up what are called IB inspectables.
Mm-hmm.
And what those do is they add some UI to the inspector in Interface Builder to let you modify the value of it in exactly the same way you would modify any of the other values that your UI classes have. So a text field, you can set the text, and then that text will show up at runtime for that particular instance of the UI text field. You can then set your own thing that will have that value when you run it at runtime. And it's some pretty neat stuff that there are a whole bunch of different types. And I had not been aware of exactly how many types are supported now. There's numbers, there's text, there's colors. Where's my list of things here? Boolean, localized strings. I don't know that. Localized strings. Rectangles, points, sizes, ranges, all sorts of stuff. And apparently they're adding images in iOS 8. So, you know, it's some crazy, crazy stuff. You have to do all this. And that's all tied to the user-defined... Oh, man, I lost it. User-defined
runtime attributes. Runtime
attributes, yes. My notes are... I have so many notes. They're very small. So if you do this, so the new UI, which loads better than using this user-defined runtime attribute UI, it's customized for what type it is. You use those things, but when you set them in there and then you go to the user-defined runtime attributes section, they're also set there. So they're actually reusing that capability.
Okay.
But with the UI, it's actually kind of interesting. So it's different for each type, but it's also, I added a couple of different types to my, you know, little sample class. And not only do they list them all, but they have a little divider between the different types of entries there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting, right? Because whenever you have UI that is machine generated,
right,
there's always this push and pull between things which are designed by people and things which are designed by machines. The things designed by machines generally don't look as nice, have unintended consequences, that sort of thing. And what it seems they're doing here is they're saying, well, yes, these are machine defined based on what you do in your code, but we're going to try to add some little nice touches in there. So that's nice, and I appreciate that.
Actually, Apple's been a leader of like machine generated user interfaces for a while. Do you remember the direct web stuff in WebObjects?
Well, that was a while ago, but
but yeah, it would also do runtime generation of user interfaces, and that was also with a rule system that was really interesting. I really liked it a lot. It definitely had some sharp edges on it in terms of how you had to kind of change your mental model of how things would work. But of course, HTML is pretty expressive in how you could do a user interface, and sure, it was a really interesting system. A more modern example is that we've mentioned on the show before. When you could actually, in Xcode 3, you could drag your entities from the data modeler into Interface Builder, and it would generate a user interface for that.
Does it still do that?
It doesn't do that anymore. There was some sort of wizardish thing or assistant thing that would do it in Xcode 4, I think, or something, or maybe 4.3 or something. But I don't think it's around anymore either. So it's like, too bad, you got to design your own user interface now if you use Core Data. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call it a pattern with Apple, because these examples they're giving are fairly spotty and they tend to take it back away. But when they do it, it's interesting.
But the direct web stuff actually was pretty cool in terms of how it would give you this kind of like a pretty sensible defaults, but then you'd actually customize it with the rule system. And so it was... And you could basically easily add your type of niceties in a very cool way. So, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Could kind of open your mind to how user interfaces, even if they're machine-generated, can actually look pretty nice.
Anyway. Sure. Then the last thing I wanted to talk about with this one was that when you figure what's going on with this is that Apple is, Xcode, is running your framework code under the hood.
Right.
And they're trying to do it kind of secretly and seamlessly, and my notes at this point or later talked about how seamlessly is unseemly. I tend to not like it when Apple tries to do magic under the hood, because that means that there's points of failure that you can't reach. But it is nice here that they added one extra thing about it, which is that you can debug this if you really want to. And what do? You go to, you select the view, you go to the editor, menu and you select debug selected views.
Mm.
And if you do that, then any breakpoints you've set in your code will be hit. It will run your view again and it will hit your breakpoints. So that's good. Actually, in terms of things that impress me, this is actually one of the biggest, because it means they do have magic. You can't get to it. Like, logging statements don't work because, you know, they're running this stuff in some weird other place that you can't get to, but you can debug it. And that's pretty cool. I'll take that and I'll give them credit for that they do it. That's going to let you get around, you know, because again, if you can't log, then breakpoints are all you have. And so, you know, it's good. I'll take it. And so overall, you know, pretty good thumbs up for this feature. I do like it. I think I am going to use it. And in fact, again, it's going to annoy me that I have to make frameworks for it, but I think I'm pretty much going to use it whenever I can, at least at first, and see how it feels to just use it all the time, just always have live views.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost one of those things. In fact, I wonder if I could even like talk you into, it sounds like you wrote a little Spike app here to check things out. You might want to upload that to GitHub because you've already gone through these pains of building up the framework. So this could actually be, you know, how many times you just want to test some things or use it as a starting point. That this sounds like a good little place you can rip off another copy of and throw some code in there for live view debugging.
Right. One of the last things that was interesting is, because it's live, it's not just live for what you do, it's live not just live for your IB inspectable stuff, it's live for everything. So if you set other runtime attributes on it, they will also show up in ways that they didn't before. So one of the go-to things that I've done in the past is, because they don't have exposed the layer attributes in IB, something I've always been kind of annoyed at that they never did that. Now, if you set them as runtime attributes, so if you say layer dot corner radius equals whatever, that was always a nice way, although a bit of a hidden way, to set those values without having to do it in code. And now when you do it, it shows up in Interface Builder if it's a live view. So that's nice. I like that as well. So. Alrighty, so next up, we are probably running out of time a little bit. Let's talk for a second about size classes, which is something that also Xcode also has a bunch of support for. Now, you know, presumably you know what size classes are at this point. Wolf?
Size classes? No, I don't. What are you talking about?
Well, that's the new way of handling portrait versus landscape and iPhone.
I was spacey. I think it was, thought it was some sort of Swift language feature that I somehow skipped.
Right. So there's support in various places in Xcode for this, such as in asset catalogs. You can now specify things by their size classes, compact or regular, for length versus width, for X versus Y axes. I am still on the fence about what this means for Xcode, because I think it feels like a bit of a step back from the custom crafted iPhone and iPad UIs that we had to use earlier.
I hear you.
Because when you have to define everything specifically, when you have to design iPad specific, you are forced to really think through what the UI is going to look like, how it's going to act, how the user is going to experience it. Whereas if you have something where you say, well, this is just a bigger version of that, then you're losing some of that. You're giving some of that up. You're abstracting some of that away. It's probably a necessary step if we're going to get a ton of more different sizes for devices.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tweet during WWDC from someone whose Twitter handle was Elizabeth Thinks, where it consisted of two quotes. One of them was from Apple Presenter saying, all these screen sizes can seem so intimidating to develop on. And then the second quote was from Android developers, and it was just, mwah! Because the idea being, you know, Android developers have had to do more of this kind of abstracting out and not thinking quite so carefully about every single size for a long time, because they have a lot of different devices. And again, Apple's probably going towards that. But I would like it more if they could tell us, you know, just tell us what the sizes are, you know, so we can tell what to optimize for. Because if the idea is, well, I'm going to make new UI that can fit any size. Well, no, you're not. You're going to make crappy UI that can fit any size. You're not going to make something that's really devoted, that's not going to do the make the hard choices that are necessary for the particular sizes that you have. So I wish they would tell us what the new stuff was. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can write your code now to make all this work.
You can do basically a thing that won't look good, right? I mean, I like this idea of where you can target specific sizes and then maybe have a quote-unquote generic size for future. I like it technically, but with brass tacks, it doesn't look good. It will never look good for a custom designed UI for a specific screen size.
And I'm concerned about how there's still the same level of complexity, but it's distributed differently. You're still making the same choices about where things are going to go, landscape versus portrait, iPad versus iPhone, but it's hidden because you're not saying what it is anymore. Mm. You're distributing it according to rules which sound generic but aren't really.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm sure we'll come back to it, but I haven't played around too much with that just now, but I know there is support for it in Xcode. In IB, you can now have a canvas that is any size, that is an arbitrary size.
Mm-hmm.
So, I know this is Apple's way of dealing with the fact that they can't tell you what's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, happier topics. Swift Playgrounds. Have you played around with these, Wolf?
Of course.
Yeah, so I haven't played around with it that much. Hopefully you might have some time to talk about this at the end. There is a document called Exploring and Evaluating Swift Code in a Playground that I will put a link to, the developer.apple.com website. I've tried a couple things out. Now you can add your own playground to Xcode. It's just a new file type.
Mm-hmm.
And it's under source. It's not under resource or anything like that. So in the same place you'd see Cocoa Touch class or header class or C file, go there, add that, or create that. You don't necessarily need to add it to your project. I did play around with it a little bit before the show started. It does seem to work as advertised. There are some interesting graphical displays of your variable state.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually do a literal graph of your variable state, of your numbers that you create, number values that you add to a variable. And there's this previews of views that you can use as well. There's some interesting stuff there that didn't seem to quite work for me. Have you used the XC Playground stuff for showing a view?
No, not yet.
That didn't work for me in the way
that
described it. It seems like the most useful thing for me would be if I could take complex code that I've already created elsewhere and just play around with it and add it in and try it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how that's going to work. I'm not sure.
But of course, the complicated code you've already written is on Objective-C, which you can't put into Swift Playgrounds. So.
Well, right. No, but I do mean when I do start writing Swift applications. Right. So, and I don't know how that's going to work yet. I hope it will work. I hope you can import stuff and just have it work in this arbitrary playground. So we shall see. I'm sure I'll be writing more about that. Swift has not been my main focus right now.
Right.
And it's not the focus here either. I'm looking at Xcode features. But it is, I know a lot of people are very excited about the REPL stuff, the script-like way that you can play around with things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also excited about it as well. It's just I haven't gotten to it yet. Let's see. The last big thing I'm going to talk about is view debugging, which is the reveal-style UI thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried this, Wolf?
I have not.
Yeah, so I did finally try it. I tried it with the same sample code that I was using for live views. You may need to use live views for this. I don't know that for a fact. But what you do is you say in your debugger, you run your app, and then in your debug pane, in that toolbar with all those little incomprehensible symbols, there's now a new incomprehensible little symbol called debug view hierarchy. Now, it's got a symbol which is kind of a bit like a fat cross, and I would never have found it myself. I didn't find it myself. I had to look at a WC session, which is this 401, what's new in Xcode 6. I'll put a link there as well, where they did describe it a bit, maybe about a third or two-thirds of the way through that session. But if you click that button, then it shows you a different kind of, it looks very much like an IB canvas, but it's not quite an IB canvas. It's a different canvas, different set of widgets in it. And if you open that up and try that out, it shows you your view in the same way that live debugging shows you your view. And if you just drag around in the empty area of the canvas, it's like, what was it, like QuickDraw 3D or QuickTime 3D? Remember that plugin that you used to be able to take 3D kind of objects or files and, maneuver them all around? You could see from this side and this side, up, down, side, angled. This is very much like that.
Mm.
And it's very intuitive as well. I'm not going to explain all the widgets there. There aren't that many. There's a couple of sliders. That's it. it feels very intuitive figuring out how to make it work and showing what's in there. So I was very happy with what I saw. And I only played around with it for a couple minutes, but I like it. Now, in the same way that you didn't see the rotating, the animation that I added in Live View, you also don't see that same animation in View Debugging either, which is fine, which is all right. However, I do wonder then if it's showing it to you in a way that, again, is not very configurable. What if I have a certain state in my application, which is only hit after I do a bunch of things? What will View Debugging do then? Will I be able to get into that state, or do I have to basically add extra code in there to advance you to the right state such that that state happens when I first draw the view? I would suspect that that's the case, but I don't know, because this isn't quite really debugging. This is still more like Live Views, a different way to look at Live Views than it is running your app inside of Xcode itself and showing what it is inside of Xcode itself.
Kind of has a feel like of the iOS simulator, right? It's like close, and you can make decisions and stuff like that, but it's not the real deal.
It's not the real deal, and probably the real deal would be harder than they want to deal with, because again, that would be running your whole app inside of it. And I should have tried it before we started, but I would bet it's the same sort of thing, that they're basically running your framework the same way they did before. But it's still pretty cool. It's still neat. I have not used Reveal myself, so I don't know what's in Reveal that isn't in here. I would bet that there's a bunch of things that Reveal, because again, if Reveal is your full app, then you would be able to advance to certain later states in your application easier in Reveal than you can here. So that's that. Now, there's a bunch of things I didn't get to. I will mention a couple of them. Storyboards now exist for OS X, and I don't do much OS X stuff anymore, so I don't use that. I did kind of look at a new app that did that. It seemed fine. I'm not sure storyboards seem to me to be very tied to the UI view controller infrastructure that you have in iOS. So I would be curious what people think about that for OS X, whether they think it's really worth it. But I think if you have a very simple OS X app, having those connections between views and dealing with it all in one big canvas will probably have the same benefits there that it has in iOS. So I think it's worth checking out. Custom fonts now show up in IB, probably the same sort of idea with the rest of their kind of Live View. They're trying to make your IB stuff look more like the real app. So that's good. I actually dealt with this recently in a client app where they used a lot of custom fonts, and you couldn't see it. So it's better now. There's apparently a brand new instruments interface. I haven't tried that yet. Let's see. And there's ways to do performance testing in Xcode during your unit tests. Now you can use measure block colon. I haven't tried that yet either, but again, just to mention some things that I didn't get to. And another thing that I wanted to get to that I didn't get to is the new localization capabilities that they have. You can apparently now preview your app in other localizations. I haven't tried this at all. Have you seen demos of this, Wolf?
Pretty much the same demos you've seen on the videos.
I haven't even seen the demos of it yet. I didn't even get to that.
I'm sure there's a more in detail one. Yeah. I think it was that even like the State of the Union had a little bit of that or something.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty kind of glossed over, but it looked impressive.
And to go along with that, there's quick look previews, and maybe some of that is in Xcode 5, but I haven't spent a lot of time with it either in Xcode 5 or Xcode 6. Some of the debugging stuff you can do with quick look previews seems really interesting. You're basically showing your view as part of just, clicking sort of this eye icon. I've never really needed it for the stuff I've been working on. But if you do need it, I think it could be very interesting. And it looks really swag. I'm sure there are qualifications to it, things that you can't quite do again like that. It doesn't animate probably. But but if I had time, I would take a look at that as well. So that's a whirlwind tour of what I have so far looked at in Xcode 6. And again, this isn't a rant. There are some things where I'm a little annoyed that they only brought stuff back that they had before. But, hey, at least they're bringing it back. And there are, I'm sure if you talk to people, they would say, well, the old way wasn't that good. Now we're improving on it. We're giving ourselves a solid foundation to make it better. I think in some ways this just means, the people who worked on it before are gone. So now we're working on it and we have a different way of thinking about it. But in any case, it really feels like they feel like they have done the groundwork, and now they can pile on the features.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it for me.
Okay, well, along those lines of what you're talking about, that you thought it'd be the cycle, the old people are gone, and that's why we can say, oh, we laid new groundwork. Well, and Apple has. In many ways, XPC was the bell of the WWDC 14 ball.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That this, a lot of the stuff that came out was because XPC had matured. You know, obviously it started with the C interface, and then you bolted the Objective-C interface on, and it started on the Mac, and it's finally, and I know that they use it behind the scenes for iOS 7 with the remote view controllers, and maybe even iOS 6 for some things. But it seemed to one of these things that, you know, they did their homework, they ate their vegetables, and they... And, you know, they put in the time, and they let it mature, and they found the issues, and they stomped them out. And so XPC is here, and that is a new foundation. And one of the things, like, I don't think I've mentioned on the show before, but I think I might blog this or something, that, you know, sandboxing actually was a technology that I've wanted since 1995. I always thought it was wrong that an arbitrary app that I install could rewrite all my files without my permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have talked about it on the show. And
I'm not sure, but that makes sense what you're saying.
Yeah, and so is this the way kind of the ham-fisted politics that came along for the ride with the App Store and stuff like that? It was all very top-down, very, you know, they're telling you, I think Cable's tweet on that said, you know, kind of Apple putting you in your place. And there was very little communication back and forth. But that said, the technology behind sandboxing, even though it's, you know, kind of grossly bolted on to OS X, I've always been a big fan of sandboxing technology, and XPC is a way to do plugins in a way that works with sandboxing. And I'm so for this because I'm a big fan of plugins, and so if we can have plugins and they're safer and they're performant, you know, more power to Apple. This is awesome. So yeah, XPC is this kind of foundational type thing that actually does, it is new magic that allows us to have our, you know, basically safe IB plugins, because remember, those ran in Interface Builder's address space. So you can do whatever you want then.
Yeah.
And so I'm all for the separation concerns and the mm-hmm. security that comes along with RIDE. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Michael Tsai linked to David Smith's blog posting.
Underscore David Smith, right?
It's not underscore David. Yeah, different. That's why we call him an underscore, because there's so many David Smiths.
Okay.
Dave Smiths, I guess. He goes by. He's in Denver. And so it's the title of the article is Intents and Extensions, and I guess it was me maybe reading more into what he was writing than I should have. So this probably is a reading comprehension failure on my part, but he does say that he was talking about iOS extensions versus Android intents. And he says that their quote, their execution model is different from Android. iOS launches extension components into separate process from both the containing application and the calling application. So that's the important thing. They are actually, for some reason, I misread that, thinking that it's kind of like sub-launched your application, which seemed really weird and like resource-intensive to me for no good reason. And it turns out that was a bad design, so I'm glad Apple didn't go with that. So so I'm correcting myself in while the episode rolled, so I think that might be a new record.
There you go.
And finally...
you're live viewing yourself.
Yes, but only in a simulator, not the real deal thing. And finally... a lot of this it kind of strikes me as, you know, Apple, you know, making do with kind of the technology it has. You know, as I said, I'm a fan of XPC and stuff like that. But as I mentioned in episode 75, a few of my favorite things, and episode 77, prototype-based programming, like I'm a big fan of live development objects, real objects. And, right. You know, Interface Builders, you know, basically was halfway there. And then they took away IB plugins, and now they're adding it back. But like, if we had real persistent and development objects, these type of weird games where you have to like build a framework and then I can load it, and mm-hmm. and like, then I'm pretty sure that if you go to change your code, I don't think it just reloads your framework, does it? Do you actually get to do like live development where you like can change how you're drawing, or do you need to restart the simulator or IB at that point?
They do it for you.
Okay, they do it for you. Okay.
But they are rebuilding your framework and rerunning it.
Okay, yeah. So basically your state gets blown away, but you have the user-defined runtime attributes, so you can put some state in there.
Right. Well, this is IB, because so they're stashing away the state that you've say that you've already specified,
rewriting it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it works kind of. We talked about how it's not the real deal, but man, if we just had like real live development objects, all these hacks would just pretty much go away. But apparently, it's just too much to ask for.
It is. It is. I mean, I think for them, it is because they're trying to ship. I think the fact that they're getting closer with something that they are going to ship, you know, I give them a lot of grief. I had a tweet a while ago that was kind of a subtweet because I didn't really say what I meant, that tinkering while you're in the air is the only way to fly. Because it really is. If you want to make significant changes to a significant thing, you've got to do it while you're shipping, while you're in the midst of shipping. And Apple is doing that. Apple is making major changes. They can't change everything. They can't give you a Swift language, which has all of the wonderful things that I'm sure their smart people would want it to have, because they've got to ship something that still works. And they can't give you, you know, live objects, because they've got to come up with stuff that will still work with their linker, with the way their linker currently works.
Right.
I wonder if with Swift, they will be able to give you more of that. I mean, playgrounds are a taste of things to come.
Right, right. Maybe, I am heartened by the REPL. It'd be interesting to see. You know,
yes, you are. I get the tweet where you said you mentioned REPL was part of C4. It was very interesting.
Yeah, so I am interested in seeing how much of Xcode 6 versus what's in 10.10. I guess I have 10.10 now. I can go take a look at it. It's heaven. I wonder how much of like a Swift kind of runtime thing will even be in 10.10 without the Xcode tools. Like, will you be able to run, like, write Swift shell scripts that comes with a stock 10.10 installation? That's going to be very interesting.
Well, I would doubt it at the moment. I think one of the troubles with the playgrounds is that they really are heavily dependent on LLVM.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if LLVM, the developer tool, will be by default in an Xcode, an OS X installation, the way your scripting stuff is in an OS X installation.
Well, yes and no, because doesn't OpenCL also use LLVM in the back end for like compiling to, whether you have it depending on the video card or if you don't have anything subtle enough, then it goes to your CPU?
Right, but remember that LLVM is a library, so they could be embedding it in whatever their OpenCL, is that what you're saying? The tools that they have, they could be embedding a separate version of it, mm-hmm. as opposed to having something which is Swift. Although they could give you a Swift, you know, a Swift executable, I guess, the command line executable. They could certainly do that. And that's the way they should do it, right? Because then they're not exposing too much to anyone. They're just saying, well, this is your Swift tool. Of course, that's what you want. Yeah, sure. They could do that. That would be neat.
Okay. Good. We're agreed. It would be neat. Get to it, Apple.
Yeah, because they don't have anything else to do. They're not in the middle of anything else.
Okay, right, that does it for me.
Yeah. All right, cool. So we will see you next time.